Subcontractors live in a sort of netherworld. They often don't deal directly with the government, and they're subject to the capriciousness of the primes. Tim Sullivan is a veteran of the contracting world and writer of the blog 10 Myths of Government Contracting. For the next six Tuesdays, we'll be exploring these myths with him. In today's installment, Sullivan tackles myth number four. It's better to work as a subcontractor because our company won't be exposed directly to the government the way a prime is. Well, you better rethink that one.
What I'm really referring to here is the myth that some people believe that by staying as a subcontractor, they're staying, if you will, beneath the surface and out of harm's way in terms of the things the U.S. government can do to a contractor. That's what I'm talking about. And the fact is that most smart primes, if they know what they're doing, and they do, will flow down most of the things from their prime contract to the subcontractors. So anyone who somehow thinks that they're not exposed to the U.S. government and what it can do to a contractor because they're a sub is fooling himself.
So what are some of the things that subs often think that can't happen to them because they are subs?
Well, they don't believe they don't have privity with the government. That is a direct contractual relationship. And so they think that if the government has problems with the prime, they're going to take it out on the prime and they can't reach the sub. They think that their people won't be interfacing, their subcontractor personnel won't be interfacing with the government people, which is ridiculous when you think about it. And they think that if they do something really wrong, then they might have a buffer layer between them and the government that prevents them from being hit. And they're just simply wrong about that.
So, for example, all of the ethics regulations, such as gratuities and considerations and so forth, those all apply to subs.
Oh, absolutely. If someone were to engage in unethical conduct, a bribe, an improper gratuity of a big nature, the government isn't worried about being someone being a subcontractor. They can suspend and debar any company that they want that's doing business with the government either as a prime or a sub, number one. And number two, if the improper activities amount to a crime, the government's not going to be worried about privity of contract. The Justice Department will simply indict a company or an individual working for a subcontractor or a subcontractor if they think the company has committed a crime. So the fact that they're a subcontractor means nothing in situations like that.
And recently, the administration launched an executive order to try to enforce better labor practices, even better than are required legally in some cases for federal contractors. That, too, could apply to at least the first layer of subs.
Oh, absolutely. It's absolutely going to apply to primes. But if you think about it for a second, if it weren't for the statutory requirement that primes, large business primes, must subcontract to small and disadvantaged businesses. If it weren't for that, in theory, a prime could do everything on a contract on its own, in theory. Now, in fact, they don't, number one, in the government contract space, because there are statutory requirements that they subcontract to small businesses. But secondly, because sometimes primes don't have the skills, and they have to go outside to bring those skills in to perform the contract. And the fact that the prime decides to sub or not isn't going to affect the government in terms of the applicability of the rules it has imposed on the prime. If there are labor rules that the prime is supposed to follow, the prime must flow those down to the sub. And the sub's going to have to perform in accordance with those rules and executive orders, whatever it might be as well. And the best example, I would say, is President Obama, shortly after being elected, I think within a month, in 2008, he was elected in 2008. So at the end of January 2009, he signed an executive order that basically requires service contractors in the government contract space to literally offer a right of first refusal to the worker bee service employees who are working for the incumbent contractor. And that applies to primes and subs. It's very clear.
And more recently, the cybersecurity regulations and supply chain, that's actually law, not regulation, but it was turned into regulation, the supply chain security for parts and so forth, that goes way down deep into the subcontracting levels.
Absolutely, because that's where the problems originate. And so they have to reach out and try and get down there. That's the purpose.
We're speaking with Tim Sullivan, a partner at Thompson Coburn. And all of the small business requirements, a sub could be brought in as a way for a prime to get at its small business requirements, but often the primes themselves, is it true, are subject to small business requirements in terms of the amount of contracting they do?
Oh, absolutely. If the terms get a little screwy. You like to call them large businesses or small businesses, but the way the Small Business Administration and the government look at them, you're a small business or you're other than small. And if you're a prime contractor and you are other than small, and so a large business, you are going to have a statutorily imposed requirement to subcontract a fair proportion of that contract to small and disadvantaged businesses. And you'll have a small business subcontracting plan. You've got to do that. And that is a very serious requirement that all the big boys, all the big names out there take very seriously. And they're constantly recruiting for competent small businesses, women-owned businesses, 8A businesses, veteran-owned businesses to be on their team so they can meet these requirements.
You've pointed out an area where being a subcontractor actually exposes a company to more risk than being a prime.
Right. I in my myth, the myth number four is what we're talking about. The biggest one is payment. If you're a prime contractor, you've got something called the Prompt Payment Act in your corner, which really has done a great job since the early 1980s of making sure primes get paid on a prompt and timely basis. But subcontractors are relying on the language that's in their agreement, their subcontract between them and the prime, or them and a higher tier subcontractor. And the devil's in the details there, Tom, and those payment clauses very frequently have what we'll call a pay when paid provision. That is, the whoever the senior company is in the pecking order there will say, we'll pay you within 10 days or a reasonable time or 30 days of our being paid by the federal government. Well, what happens if the prime doesn't get paid by the federal government for, let's say, 3, 4, 5, 6 months after contract award? And under the terms of its subcontract, the prime's not going to turn around and pay its subs until it gets paid. And subs can get in big trouble that way.
They say you can die on your receivables. And also, let's face it, a lot of the big systems integrators and the large contractors have a flat-out policy of just paying everybody sometimes 45, 60, or even 90 days.
Well, right, the float time can be a killer for people, and that's why it's not always easy to get done, we push for our subcontractors to insist on language that they be paid with a certain number of days after their invoice is submitted to the prime. And the invoice means they've either delivered their product or provided their services, of course. So we push for that language whenever we can. But sometimes the subcontractors just don't have the leverage to make that language get through, and then they're stuck with pay when paid, and they're going to church a lot.
So what should subcontractors do, or companies that decide to make their living as subs, what should they do in terms of best practices for making sure their policies are in line with where they need to be?
Well, first of all, each deal has to be looked at on its own. There's no single template that works for every deal. Some are services, some are products, some are large business prime, some are small. So you have to be careful to look at each deal to make sure that the subcontract language that you're negotiating is appropriate for that deal. There is no one-size-fits-all approach to this stuff. That's number one. Number two, these subs are all busy people. And frequently what we'll hear when they come to us with problems is, you know what, we just didn't catch it, we didn't have time, we wanted to book the deal. You actually have to have someone within your organization, or you hire someone to help you, look at these things and take the time to do it, because you spend the time now rather than pay your lawyers later or find out you're not getting paid later. So you really have to take the time to look at this stuff and review it. Number three, you have to have someone within your organization or that you can have access to who understands what primes will do in these flowdowns. These flowdowns are very tricky things, and we have seen primes try, and anybody listening to this would recognize, to just dump everything in the kitchen into a subcontract, even though more than half the clauses wouldn't even be appropriate for the situation. You want to toss that stuff out. You want to clean this up and make it specific and tailored to the deal. That is very important for you. I'd finish by saying that you need to focus on two clauses in every subcontract that should be in every subcontract. And one would be choice of law. Many companies think this is a no-brainer. You don't need to worry about it. We'll always be. And the choice of law clause, Tom, is a clause that basically says if there are problems that develop under this contract, this subcontract, they'll be adjudicated under the state laws or the laws of the state of, and it's usually the state of the prime. Well, sometimes a sub can get a change to be its state, which may or may not be helpful depending on where it is. Or what we like to see is we like to tell them, Let's adjudicate problems that arise under this deal under the law of federal government contracts. And if the law of federal government contracts doesn't cover a particular issue, then whatever state the parties choose can do it. For example, most state law and state courts don't have any experience with terminations for convenience or terminations for default. But the federal law system sure does, and you have plenty of cases to look at to help guide the parties and any judge or neutral who's trying to help resolve a problem. So your disputes clauses and your choice of law clauses can become very important in these situations.